Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 30th of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to say we're joined by live video Skype link by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives. And after our break today, we've got a recorded section with Alex Thompson that we covered yesterday, but that was outside the scope of our news. We'll bring that in today.
Yes, we'll just get straight on.
More good news on Brexit, Mike.
More good news on Brexit. So after the news yesterday, the letter was published, Dear President Tusk. Well, it caused a bit of a furore in one respect because it was one sentence which lots of people didn't like very much. Lots of the Remainers didn't like anyway. And it was that in security terms, a failure to reach agreement would mean our cooperation in the fight against crime and terrorism would be weakened. In this kind of scenario, both the United Kingdom and the European Union would, of course, cope with change, but it's not the outcome that either side should seek. Theresa May here saying security more fragile than ever at any time since the Cold War, weakening our cooperation and failings to stand up for European values would be a costly mistake. And it was this business of a costly mistake. Some people were trying to blow up into some kind of threat towards the European Union. Well, what did David Davis have to say? Because, of course, part and parcel of this, as we mentioned yesterday, is the Acquis Communautaire, which is bringing in the European Union law, turning that into UK domestic law. And David Davis was discussing some of this on Radio 4 this morning. But one of the key things that he was saying was that he wants the exact same benefits from the European Union as we have at the moment. He was being challenged by the BBC on this. Brian, it seems to me that we can only have the same benefits if we have the same obligations. So David Davis wants the same benefits. Theresa May wants the same benefits. They say that we carry the same obligations until the day we leave the European Union, but this suggests that we carry those obligations after that as well.
Well, that's the way I see it. Nothing is going to change. We're just going to have months, years of bluster and debate on the surface, and underneath it, life will go on exactly as if nothing has happened.
Right. So let's look at a fake news story from today. Here it is, BBC. Brexit, UK to set out plans to replace all EU laws. This is their headline. UK to set out plans to replace all EU laws. And they say thousands of EU laws on everything from workers' rights to environment are set to be scrapped, they say. They're going to be scrapped. This is utter nonsense. There's not a single EU law is going to be scrapped. We're converting EU law that applies in this country to UK domestic law. So this is total lies. David Davis, again, because he was saying quite a lot on Radio 4 this morning, saying that, first of all, we're going to bring all the European Acquis Communautaire, as they call it, the law, into British law. That means under Parliament's control and government's control. So it's being given this veneer of credibility by saying that we're going to bring 40 years worth of law into the UK and it's going to come under Parliament's control and government's control.
Yeah, the parliamentary bit, or the Parliament control, of course, is reinforcing the idea that you've got a Parliament is sovereign. Parliament simply creates the law.
Right.
So there's something very dangerous going on here.
Absolutely. That's an important point. So he said one of the things that takes all the time is actually getting standards harmonised, safety standards, for example. He said we're going to be in exactly the same place on the day we leave the European Union as we are today because of this. He said that that's why today he's publishing the white paper on taking on board all the European laws. So on the day we leave, we're in exactly the same position. This gives certainty and allows the European Union members to begin a negotiation from a starting point that nobody else has. There are two stages to this. Number one, as we bring all the European law into British law, that means it's under Parliament's control and government's control. And after that, government and Parliament can take as long as they like to focus on what they are going to improve and change. We've got 40 years of laws, thousands and thousands of regulations on the British statute book. Many of them are good and won't need changing. Some people will want that change and they'll have the ability to do that from now on. This is what he claims. And I'm going to ask, is this a likely scenario that we're going to look at these thousands and thousands of laws and regulations We're entering a two-year negotiation, is what they're saying, and at the end of it, we're going to leave with a new deal, is what they're saying. And at that point, we're going to start looking at the law that we've wrapped into the onto the UK statute book. I don't think so.
I don't think so. And one of the things we should highlight, of course, we're not just talking a few thousand pieces of legislation. We're talking, to the best of my knowledge, well over 170,000. So that this is massive amounts of legislation which came in over the years from the European Union.
Absolutely. Now, Theresa May, of course, in her presentation to Parliament yesterday when she was discussing the letter, reinforced this thing that we've been talking about for a number of weeks now. I want this to be a truly global Britain, the best friend and neighbour to our European partners, but a country that reaches beyond the borders of Europe too. And if we go back to David Davis and his comments this morning again, this is what he said, that the trade deals, the free trade deals, are the prize. This is what they're aiming for. They're absolutely open about it if you actually drill down into the words that they're using. And I just wanted to remind everybody of what happened in the run-up to the referendum in the first place. Because if you remember, David Cameron had a bunch of adventures in Europe. He travelled all through Europe, met all the leaders of all the European member states, and discussed the new relationship that Britain would have with the European Union, should we have voted to remain within the European Union. And the result of that adventure, these adventures in Europe, was this, the best of both worlds, the United Kingdom's special status in a reformed European Union. The key point about this document was he came back, it was presented to Parliament, it became sort of the basis of his campaign platform for the referendum. And it was absolutely a legally binding agreement with the other EU member states. It says in this that the decision is binding in international law on all EU countries and will take effect immediately if the British vote to remain in the EU. It will be registered at the United Nations, as the Danish decision was in 1992. Now, what it does say in here is that the European Council agreed that, should the result of the referendum be a vote that the UK should leave the EU, this new settlement for the UK will cease to exist. So this document no longer exists. But if you read this document, you discover that the policies in this document are exactly the policies that Theresa May is presenting at the moment. So here is a document that came out of a round of negotiation that David Cameron did travelling throughout Europe in 2015. This is the result of it. It was considered legally binding until such times as there was a referendum and we voted to leave. But the contents of this document absolutely apply today because this is exactly the same policy that Theresa May is pushing. And right at the heart of it, of course, is trade deals. So what they're saying here is at the same time, the UK benefits from the EU's greater economic leverage, which has allowed it to negotiate advantageous free trade agreements with more than 50 other countries. This allows us to take advantage of growth opportunities around the world, concluding all the trade deals already underway would ultimately be worth in total more than £20 billion a year to the UK GDP. Once these deals are completed, around three quarters of UK exports to non-EU countries would be covered by an EU negotiated free trade agreement. Now, the fact of the matter is that TTIP was a key part of this. TTIP has collapsed, and instead of the European Union being the centre of these free trade agreements, it's now Britain which is at the centre of these free trade agreements. That has been British policy from the beginning, and it continues to be. So, if again, to reiterate the point, nothing is changing as a result of Brexit. It's already written in stone. Well, here is the white paper that David Davis was talking about. This is the white paper which will legislating for the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the European Union. And there are three parts to this, three main parts to this, they say. They're going to achieve this by creating a Great Repeal Bill, and the Great Repeal Bill will do three main things. It will repeal the European Communities Act and return power to UK institutions. Well, the first point about that is that it's a lie, because nothing's going to be returned. The power cannot be returned to UK institutions under the terms of the ACUS acquis communautaire, right? Also, UK institutions are going to be bound by any agreements that are made under the terms of the of whatever final agreement is made with regard to Brexit. So we're going to, as we've said yesterday, we're going to remain within Europol, we're going to remain within EU military integration, unification rather, and all these other institutions that we want to stay part of. And second of all, they say that we're going to convert EU law as it stands at the moment of exit into UK law before we leave the EU. And finally, and this is the most important part, quite possibly, the bill will create new powers to make secondary legislation. So what is secondary legislation? Well, these are statutory instruments. Basically, there's very little, if any, parliamentary scrutiny of statutory instruments. And of course, what is this doing? It's creating a whole load of noise on the in the media and on the internet, Brian, focusing on that particular aspect of it. They're saying that this will enable corrections to be made to the laws that would otherwise no longer operate appropriately once we leave the EU, so that our legal system continues to function correctly outside the EU. And what are they doing? They're creating all this noise where everybody's shouting that parliamentary sovereignty is being subverted here, because all this EU law is going to be changed without any parliamentary scrutiny. But what fascinates me about this is that, of course, people who voted to remain won't complain too much about this, Brian, because they want EU law to stay in place. But what fascinates me is that anybody that campaigned for Brexit, there's not a single person concerned that the entire body of EU law is being turned into domestic law. And that, why is that?
Some of them don't see it, Mike, and others, well, who has actually been on the Brexit campaigning side properly. Very few people, there's a body of the people who voted, but if we talk about informed organisations, very few of them are informed.
David, I mean, the key point here is we're not going to be leaving any of the major EU institutions. All these deals are being done to integrate us further while there's talking about Brexit. And we're taking the full body of EU law. Can you explain to me how anything changes?
Nothing at all is changing, is it? It's a facade. It's a facade of a government. It's a puppet parliament. And they're attempting to sort of delude the British people. We've got serious mandate issues here, because the mandate in the referendum was to leave. And the Prime Minister could have dealt with that within 10 seconds the following morning under the royal prerogative and just said, you know, we're out under supranational treaty law. That's it, end of. And Parliament then carries on as representing the sovereign people of this nation. And it's not doing that. So we've got serious mandate issues here on several levels. I think tactically what we're heading towards is a general election, because we're getting into trouble with all this, because nothing is changing. Brian, you're quite right on the campaigning issue, because obviously the main thing that we were seeing in the Brexit facade of a campaign was an utter refusal by all of those individuals there, whether that be Gisela Stewart, Steve Baker, whoever, Julian Brazier, Gerald Howarth, all the people that were saying they were anti-EU, an utter refusal to even mention the words of EU military unification or the process that we were engaged in. So there's serious problems there. Obviously, they've got another agenda. So you're quite right in terms of the deals. And the real deal, I believe, and I suspect, and this is my strategic forecast, is that the military union has been agreed by May. And I'm basing that on what she's saying, what she's not saying, and Fallon's actions recently with Germany announcing enhanced defence union. So Theresa May is currently saying that, of course, we will still cooperate fully with Europe on security. And I think that security word means everything. That's the all-in concept for the whole of the military and police and so on and so forth. That's lock, stock and Her Majesty's barrels, everything. So, you know, we've got a timing issue there as well, because obviously timing-wise, while all this is going on, it makes it very easy. But in terms of the law, I mean, all the banter, all the prevarication was that Parliament wasn't making the laws, and we wanted to make Parliament make the laws and not the EU. So where's the sense there then that we adopt the EU law? Well, now hang on a minute. They want their cake and eat it now. That's not what the argument was. We're going back to a mandate problem, and just an utter facade. This isn't Brexit. This isn't leaving. There's none of it leaving. If we import their laws, we're staying in. It's as simple as that.
David, I just want to come back to this document again. This is David Cameron's best of both worlds document. As I say, because we voted to leave the EU, this is no longer a legally binding document. But the fact of the matter is that Jean-Claude Juncker was making EU military union a condition of this document at the end of 2015. So when this document was released to the public in February 2016, EU military union was already a done deal because this was a legally binding agreement. And Juncker had already made it clear that military union was a condition of this agreement.
Yeah, completely. Because it's vital. We've said this all along. It's utterly vital to the entire concept of the total unification of Europe. Required currency unification, military unification, then it can have its treasury, and then it's a state, and it's a fundamental component. So we're seeing this nonsense within, the Labour Party doing nothing with this, the UKIP are doing nothing with it, and the Tories are just ramming it through, or the tiny control group that operate the Tory Party are ramming it through. So it is, it's a done deal, and I think, and it's pretty clear that deal has been agreed, and now we're going through the facade of this nonsense with Mrs. May putting the letter in and saying we're triggering Article 50, because this is an utter load of nonsense. It's an utter total and utter facade of what the reality actually is. We've said this all along, with Fallon going over and announcing enhanced defence union with Germany very, very soon after Brexit. And then we see the CGRM, General McGowan, going to Potsdam. And that's when we suspected he activated the EU military C3 at that point in Potsdam. So, we can see this. But the problem is, of course, is that there's no challenging going on a mass level, on a big enough level. Now, I'm reassured that this is the case because I've just met with a tier one MOD supplier who is saying that all of the British Army's vehicles, now that's from a Challenger tank all the way down to a Land Rover, are going to be homologated to comply with EU regulations. And that's now. That's on the table. So we can pretty safely say that this is happening. Now, there's two other things that have happened over the last couple of weeks. We've just become aware that quite a few senior officers at the rank of either head of service as a First Sea Lord, Admiral or General, and Chief of Defence Staff are trying to inquire through the sort of traditional old boy network of merely communicating, as they would have done for decades before, with the current in-service generals, keeping an eye on them, as a bit like sort of, the old boys, and they're meeting a stone wall. And the reason for this is they can't get any information about what's going on because it's official secrets and it's policy and the government are doing it. So they need to realise that this is the case. And then the big issue here is everybody, Farage is wonderful, isn't he? He keeps going on about immigration and border control. Well, what use is that without your own military? Yep. Or control of your own security services? Because this is an all-in concept. So he's run away from this, and he's run away from me personally on it, refused to challenge it, as have all of their command networks. That's Andy Wigmore, Rob Oxley, Matthew Elliott, all the people at Vote Leave, refuse to even use the wording. So this is how serious this is. This was the big issue. This was the trade deal. And we were told by an insider in Number 10 that May's tactic, i.e. the facade of our government, as that she represents, was that they would trade in the military in order to get the trade deal. Well, that's an utter nonsense. Utter nonsense, because what they've done is they've served the EU. They haven't served the British people. Yep. So I think we're getting very close to very dangerous territory, even worse than what we were in 72 with our constitution, with mandates, with people in government acting outside of their office. And, this is really, really dangerous territory. We've just effectively surrendered our military to the EU.
Yep.
That's what's happened.
David, if I can just come in here, it's very interesting. Some individuals in our chat room are picking up on the fact it comes back to the quality of the people that we've got in Westminster. So let's come in at a different angle. You've given a brilliant summary there of of what's happened. You've talked about a facade. This is not in the interests of the British people. Military given away. Well, here's a group of the pro-European lovies outside of Parliament as part of an Open Britain debate. So we've got Nicky Morgan, we've got Nick Clegg, and the man of great interest to me is Nottingham MP, Labour MP, Chris Leslie. Let's just highlight Mr. Leslie, if we can. There we are. And what is all this about? Well, they're making a huge fuss, of course, that we're going to lose a whole heap of things if we break away from the EU. And I've highlighted there with a big arrow, rights. They are very, very desperate that human rights are protected because that's what the European Union is all about. So I think since the man in the spotlight is Chris Leslie, let's remind people that this is the duplicitous MP who was very happy to have the publicity photographs glad-handing Melanie Shaw when he thought there was some benefit to her. Remember that Melanie at one stage actually worked in this gentleman's office, his constituency office. What has he done since she has been in prison? Absolutely nothing. He's organised no street protests. He's had no proper mainstream publicity on her case. He has done absolutely nothing whatsoever to help child abuse whistleblower Melanie Shaw. So we are now seeing the quality of these MPs. I'm using a word like duplicitous or hypocrite. I'd like to use some much harsher adjectives, but we've got rules on that in UK column. These people are despicable. And if we follow the little pattern through, let's come in at this angle, because if we remember, it was the former chief constable of Nottinghamshire Police whose team were harassing Melanie Shaw. He did nothing to stop it. And I'm going to contrast him with this man, Mike Veal, the man who has bravely put this video up talking about his investigation into Ted Heath. And I'm going to say, as a result of reaction from UK column viewers, the number of views on that video has gone up from a mere 1,500 to nearly 4,000 now. And we are saying, please keep supporting Mr. Veal because he's doing his job, whereas it's very clear that Chris Eyre was not doing his job. And if we continue on the theme, this is another Nottingham case. We've got the police across UK searching for this woman who supposedly abducted her two boys. I'd like to just say that what is actually going on is that the police and the press and the media in UK are concealing information from the public. Sorry, there's two froms in there, from the public, as Mother Samantha Baldwin tries to protect her children and is branded the abductor. Now, this is an old story, as it were. This is a template. It's happened to many mothers and fathers. This is just a list of some of the articles at the moment saying that the press, the police are hunting this lady, but they give no detail of the real facts of this case. And the template is that mother has turned to social services for help in protecting her children. She then becomes the victim and is now being hounded across the country. And I'll bring in this gentleman. We believe that this is the judge who's been handling the case, Judge Jeremy Lee. We think there's some sort of restriction or gagging order on the mother. This is a report from the Nottingham Post, and I was intrigued to see that he'd been raising money for a charity, Faith in Families. He's actually chairman of the trustees. But what are these? What is Faith in Families? Well, it's a registered charity and an independent adoption agency. So we've got a family court judge sitting in cases deciding children are going to come up for adoption, and then he's helping to run an adoption agency. Is it just me, Mike, or is this a conflict of interest?
It is the most disgusting conflict of interest. And so the question is, when a mother comes up in front of him, having attempted to get help from social services to protect her children, social services then decide to try to take those children from the mother, what's his decision going to be?
Well, this is a very good question. And we'll just add this one in, because we had a phone call this morning to say, well, don't forget that this former Nottingham social worker Andris Loggins was jailed for the abuse of youngsters at none other than Beechwood Children's Home in Nottingham. And as the little inset LinkedIn page there gives, this man as working at the very same Faith in Families organisation. Now, did the judge know this? He probably didn't. But what we're showing is no separation of powers. But what's my main point here? We've come in from Brexit to child abuse. Well, my point is that now even MPs are admitting that Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Theresa May, knows about the child abuse rings in Westminster. She knows fully what is going on, but those MPs say she is incapable of doing anything about it. And I would suggest that if Theresa May is incapable of doing anything about child abuse in Westminster and the British government, she's incapable of doing anything with regard to policy in the European Union. She's surely just a puppet in what she's doing in, with regard to Brexit, Mike.
Well, as I said, everything she's doing echoes what David Cameron was doing before her. He was a puppet. Where is the policy coming from? That is the question.
Presumably it's the most powerful banking interests, and we'll leave that for another day. David, would you like to just give us 20 seconds to close on that section, and then we've got a couple of adverts coming up?
I completely concur. No separation of powers. We've got conflicts of interest. It's, you know, blatantly apparent, you know, that the stuff, there's so many things here that are wrong. But unfortunately, every time you come to want to go to the people that are supposed to deal with this, which is your MPs, on whatever the issue is, you end up hitting the wall because they represent the party first and foremost. And that's a whipped system. And as you've very accurately clearly demonstrated there, Brian, you know, under that Tim Fortescue clip, you can see how it operates. This is why nothing seems to ever get through and get resolved, because it is just one big, never mind about Trump saying about drain the swamp, but, you know, we've got a cesspit there in Whitehall. It's as simple as that. That's why we cannot resolve anything. I'll tell you what really made me think last night. The wife and I sat watching the program where they go in and do the person's house up because they've got disabilities or problems. There was a lady and a gentleman on there with a woman had had a stroke and in childbirth and had two twins. And there was about 150 tradesmen turned up and turned around these people's lives. And I looked at Amy and I said, the problem in our country isn't the people. There's nothing wrong with us, the people. The problem is in Westminster.
Yeah.
End of.
Totally agree with that. Thank you, David.
Okay, quick ad then. Tonight, 7 p.m. In the Cabana restaurant in Glasgow, Identity and Truth, a meeting with Gilad Atzmon is being run by David Scott. Please do get along and support that if you can. Tickets available from Eventbrite before you get there, and that's at £7 or £10 on the door.
Excellent. And also a reminder, 22nd of April, the Great Moot, the meeting in Nottingham. Ticket sales are going well for this, but if you haven't bought a ticket already, please get in and get that booked. This is about bringing people together to exchange ideas. It is not about set piece talks.
Right. As Brian mentioned, we basically ran out of time during yesterday's news programme, and we had still quite a bit to cover with Alex Thompson. So we decided that we would record that anyway. And we're going to show that now. We're beginning by discussing the French election. So, Alex, the French election, this is from AFP, and you wanted to highlight the little infographic here.
This is just one French newspaper's attempts, Les Echos, to illustrate the number of ways in which French justice can work. Now, those of us in English-speaking countries tend to assume that if we are suspected of something, we may be charged by the police, and that having been charged by the police or by a private prosecutor in the more classic setup, we might actually have a court date in which we're going to be judged guilty or not guilty or no case to answer, or in Scotland, not proven. But French justice and the continental justice more widely can go any number of other ways. And all these arrows are ways in which François Fillon, the presidential candidate who's accused now of having improperly employed his wife and daughters, he could be sort of acquitted, sort of suspected, sort of interrogated, You can go from almost acquitted to almost guilty, and then back again from almost guilty to almost innocent. Basically, a juge d'instruction, or investigating magistrate, calls you in, which Mrs. Fillon, who's a Welsh woman, now has to do as well, by the way, and says, can I have a little chat with you? It's obligatory, of course. Give me a little chat about what you've been up to. And at the end of that, if you're foolish enough, I'm sure the Fillons won't be, they will say, well, OK, am I innocent or guilty then? Or do I have a case to answer or not? And the investigating magistrate will say, no, 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 you don't understand. I'm going to sit on this and you might be called back tomorrow or next year. And of course, in the Belgian system, they go rather further and they can hold you in administrative detention open-endedly. For some people, it goes on for years in this situation. And when they get to court, they're not addressed. Their lawyer is addressed and the lawyer is asked to answer on behalf of the client.
Yeah, this is corpus juris, isn't it? This is one of the things that credits where it's due. UKIP, many, many years ago, picked up on this one, the big difference between corpus juris and habeas corpus in this country. And we will say it's one of the key reasons why the British Constitution Group now has taken the issue of reasserting the rule of law, reasserting common law and the judgment by juries, because ultimately under our common law system, it is our jury that makes the decision, a jury of our peers. So a huge difference between the UK system of law and the European system of law. As you're pointing out, many people still don't realise the danger of this system.
That's absolutely right. And if it can reach up to the couple that's vying to be the first family of France, then absolutely nobody is safe from its clutches.
Well, let's stick with the French election then. We have a debate here between Marine Le Pen and Monsieur Macron.
A broadcaster's attempt to summarise the key points of the first round debate in 1 minute. And here we can see the two main contenders at action. This is Marine Le Pen of the Front National, who wants to be out of the EU and the Euro. Just to say her body language. And then look at Mr. Macron, who has founded a new movement. And he's saying, my project is about belief in our country, confidence in the vibrancy of our country. It's very Blairite, isn't it? I have a project of hope. Look at the hand gestures as well. And then when it gets a bit shirtier between Le Pen in the middle there and Macron, who's to her left, as we're viewing, she says a particular thing about a division in the country. And he says, no, Mrs. Le Pen, you're falling into the trap of believing in division. We need a united country. I believe in a united country. This is really Blairism 20 years after the fact, isn't it? This is Macron, who has been put up by I don't know who, to stand on a ticket of centralism and globalism, but running clean of any of the establishment parties because the French are so fed up with them now. So his financial backers have given him a platform of his own, and the French press, particularly the business press, like Les Echos, are saying at every breath they can, to leave the euro would be suicidal, we must stay in the euro, Macron is the hopeful centrist candidate. Those of us in Britain have seen this all before. You know, it's Blairism.
Les Echos here, two sort of business stories, really should be side by side here, but basically saying what France is stagnant, going backwards.
Yes, the one that you've got there, the latter one, says that France is un pays qui ne cesse de changer sans jamais vraiment bouger. So it's a country in incessant change without ever actually moving anywhere. And this article purports to be an audit of France. It's written by Jean-Marc Vittori, who is a journalist on their staff, and it's quite unprecedented for the French press to talk about this, that in the first teaser sentence of this article, it says that although France is high up the lists of global rankings still for being a good place to live and do business, in reality, France se délite de l'intérieur. France is decaying from the inside. And then it goes on with statistics showing that nobody believes that they're going to stay in the position that they're in as a country. And that at the end of the article, the journalist actually says France of the late 2010s bears many comparisons with the France of the early 1780s. In other words, that there is a pre-revolutionary sentiment brewing in France and that the entire order may be overthrown. And the one you showed first there showed that most French believe that they're nowhere near as prosperous as they were 5 years ago, that the 2010s has been a wasted decade. The country has become far more split up and unequal and hopeless than before. And this is exactly what Brian was saying on Tuesday's UK Column News when he was interviewing Nicolas together with Vanessa Bealey, which is that we don't get a squeak about France in the press, really. Well, the reason is France is where we're supposed to be heading, and even the French press is having to admit now it's a pretty depressing and hopeless situation.
Let's move on to the Netherlands then. Well, what are we looking at here, aftermath of the elections?
This is a rather shocking incident of what the Turks as a state have been able to do in Dutch politics. There's a mosque in Amsterdam East which has turned into a polling station. And if you look up this article, I know it's a Dutch headline here, but it says, look at this independent polling station in East Amsterdam. And further down that page, there's pictures of Turkish flags in the windows of the mosque. There was apparently, well, not apparently, it's been reported by multiple people, there was Turkish radio playing when people went in to vote in this polling station, which was just a mosque that had been transformed for the day. There was literature out for Diyanet, which is the Turkish government's Ministry for Religious Affairs for People Abroad, which I've talked about in the past on UK Column News. And then the city council were called in by disgruntled voters about the situation there. And the council came along and said, yes, you have to take the literature away, but there's no problem with having a foreign country's flag in the window of this polling station, and there's no problem with playing a foreign radio station while people are voting. Wow. So that's how serious the situation is now.
And in the meantime, Turkish minister, according to this independent headline, Turkish minister claims holy wars will soon begin in Europe after Geert Wilders was beaten.
And this is a classic bit of baiting by the independent, because the independent journalist who copied this from Hürriyet, a kind of liberal Turkish opposition paper, she unquestioningly took on their translation of what the foreign minister Çavuşoğlu had said. And in the rather poor Turkish translation which Hürriyet had made, they ascribed to him the sentiment that holy wars would begin. So you would assume from that he was calling for jihad in Europe or some such thing. But he didn't say jihad. He didn't even say kutsal, which is the Turkish word for holy, describing the wars. He said that the wars would be wars of deen, which is the Islamic concept of how committed are you to your religion and your way of life. So actually the point he was making was, he was not threatening directly. He was saying, I predict that there will be a confrontation inevitably between immigrants who are committed to at least some way of life and a lot of the host population who don't know what they're committed to. This is another one just after the Dutch election. Well, that's quite a Freudian slip. I'm calling it the Turkish election. That's pretty much what we've had here. This is about an ethnic Turkish member of parliament in the Netherlands for the Christian Democrat Party, roughly the equivalent of the Conservatives, sort of centrists claiming to be conservative. And he's joined a party which has got Christian in its name. And he's not an MP, I beg your pardon. He is a city councillor in the city of Rotterdam. And he has had at least temporarily to throw in the towel as a councillor because he's been having death threats. Again, the Turkish state has been getting at him and has been saying, how dare you represent a party? I don't know whether they were so annoyed that it had Christian in the name. I think it was more the case that he was not standing for the party called Denk, which now has three members of parliament, because that has set itself up as the party which all loyal Turks in the Netherlands must vote for, which stands for Turkish interests. So, again, we see a complete takeover of the Dutch political scene by the Turkish state.
And you tweeted out this. We've been trying to report on this for a week or two, but you might almost see something similar to this on a gable wall in Belfast, certain sections of Belfast anyway. But quite incredible to see King Billy with a turban.
Exactly what it is. And if you look to where the white steed is charging in a kind of romantic font, it says in the middle of the water there, kill for you. So that is the loyalists to the Turkish state, in this case, football fans. And this was taken in 2010 when Erdogan started to be a real threat. These football fans, okay, they were playing the Greeks with whom they've got bad blood. But the picture they've got on this banner is basically the Sultan conquering Constantinople, turning it into Istanbul in 1453. And just like King Billy in Belfast, so the Sultan is on his white steed in a holy war. And so he's calling calling all the Turks in Europe, basically, because this match was in Europe, to kill on behalf of, well, OK, we will be told by some people it will be kill on behalf of Islam, but it's more specific than that. They're being called upon to kill for the Turkish expansion project, the Turkish colonization of Europe.
This one here, this is an eyewitness report. Is this from the Rotterdam riots, if we can call them that?
It is indeed from that. And I have summarized here what this eyewitness said. We had another eyewitness to the Rotterdam riots on in UK column news when it happened a week or more ago. But this chap, who is an eyewitness to what happened, said this in an independent Dutch media interview. What I saw with my own eyes was covered up 12 hours later, so 12 hours after it happened, on the Sunday programmes. The diametric opposite was reported to what I saw. The Dutch public broadcaster, NOS, also known as NPO, these NOS journalists, on whom we're dependent as never before, because he says in the interview there's no local press anymore or independent press, they deliberately failed to mention hundreds of Turks yelling Erdoganite slogans, grey wolf slogans, that's extreme Turkish nationalism, and Allahu Akbar slogans dozens of times, and the press ignored their shouts of bloody Jews at the calm gendarmes. If this were a bilateral national conflict, nobody would be yelling Allahu Akbar. Our own media did exactly what the Turkish and Russian media do, propaganda, because of the forthcoming elections and because they have made a policy decision at NPO, the Dutch BBC, to, quote, foster community cohesion. And by the way, this is exactly what the German establishment media is now admitting it does as well. And this eyewitness concludes, no journalist attends an event intending to spin it. We have to look at a higher level, at which talking heads they invite into the studio. Hardened rioting youths were depicted as chummy Turkish working men next door types having a polite democratic protest. NOS's entire frame is that politics is primary. Don't let Wilders in. News is secondary. RTL, which is the other establishment lefty broadcaster in the Netherlands and Benelux, he says they're not a whit better. So we're actually starting to get people, not just from the alternative media as such or from some alternative parties, just eyewitnesses who are shocked at the disparity between what they've seen, which is very angry Turkish young men who've been told exactly what to do by Erdogan, and the reality, and the picture of that, which is reported in the public broadcasters. And I think something of this happened in London in 2011, although we didn't quite have the media scene then to come out with it.
Now, it's something that we don't have included here, but we'll give you a couple of minutes to discuss it. You took a trip around Amsterdam, I guess it was, recently for a Scottish video blogger, is that right?
That's right. It was actually a trip around the south side of Rotterdam, where there's only about 20% Dutch left. And it's the most recent series of videos on millennial woes. Channel. We've mentioned Millennial Woes' real name, Colin Robertson, before, because he had to flee Scotland for the continent after he was really persecuted very viciously by the Daily Record and by a hack there called McEwen. And David Scott was the first to mention him. Now, I've been in touch with him since, and I was one of the men guiding him around one of these, we could say, post-Dutch urban scenes in Rotterdam. So if you look for the Rotterdam Fire Nord video, which Millennial Woes uploaded just last night, about a couple of nights ago by the time this goes out, you will see me in the commenting in the section of the stills. And what was particularly shocking was that we got to a street where all the residents are Turks, and they had hung a two-story high Turkish flag out from the railing of their balcony to the railing of the balcony below. And as soon as we filmed this, actually Turkish grannies came out and filmed us with fairly sophisticated camera equipment. And then we were tailed back through the market as we tried to return to our base, as it were. So there is an advanced, I would say, Turkish state intelligence network operating in these suburbs. And the presence of the flag there itself is there to say, on this street, Turkey is the boss. Erdogan rules. We owe no loyalty to the Dutch political scene. This is, again, being presented as Islamification, and there's some arguments that it is that. But I see a very sharp spear tip in this, which is, again, the Turkish state using its diaspora. Erdogan knew what he was doing when he called on Turks in Europe last week to go up in the world, occupy the better neighborhoods, drive the best cars, have very comfortable houses, and make themselves the boss of Europe. The question, of course, is who is driving Erdogan? I don't believe he's there independently.
Indeed.
Can I just ask, Alex, and I don't want to put you on the spot live on this one, but does this tie in with, is it Gulen or the Gulen Foundation that principally has been embedded in the USA? But to me, there seems to be some cozier relationships between them. Have I got this wrong, or is that organisation possibly implicated in the Turkish movement as well?
Well, there is a tie over, Brian, but it's pretty complicated. In essence, Gulen is a CIA project. That's quite clear. And he's held in Pennsylvania as a figurehead of, you could call it, the more Islamist people who hope that he'll clean up Turkey and restore it to being a God-fearing country. And Gulen had been thought of by the NATO and CIA type planners as the way to turn the Turks into shock troops against Russia. And China in the end. But this didn't quite work. So Gulen fled to the United States at the time when Erdogan was getting off the ground, really, in politics. And he doesn't dare go back now. And he split with Erdogan. The coup which happened last summer was, as far as we can tell, was some US State Department elements using the Gulenists, so the Islamists in the schools as well, against Erdogan. And he took that as a pretext to go and clear out lots and lots of judges and academics and teachers on whom he'd had black marks for a long time because they weren't sufficiently loyal to his version of Turkish statehood. So Gulen and Erdogan have had a tiff. But they are both versions of foreign interests, largely American and Israeli, subverting Turkey and using it because of the national pride and vigor of the Turkish people, using them as a wedge between Europe and the Islamic world, and particularly between Europe and Russia.
Right. So let's move on to Hungary then. Well, you've described this as global fake news, labeling the son of a Hungarian anti-Marxist and neo-Nazi.
Yes, here in the picture we have the British-born and raised Sebastian Gorka, who's now President Trump's senior counter-terrorism advisor. And as a young man, he spent a couple of decades in Hungary, which is where his parents came from and fled communism, and particularly fled the 1956 revolt when it failed, like so many Hungarians went to France and Britain. And then he's naturalized in America and become one of the Trump people. Now, it has been discovered, as it were, in inverted commas, that Mr. Gorka has a chivalric order. He's a member of the Vitezi Rend, which is the order for chivalry or order for valor, knightly order, something like that. And he actually was given this as a kind of memory to his father's courage in being one of the many who stood up against the Stalinists in 1956. There is no what he's accused of as a result of this is being part of a neo-Nazi allied organization, and therefore he is a neo-Nazi plant in the White House. The trouble with this, of course, is that the chivalric order itself lasted from 1920 or so till the Second World War and was then disbanded. When the communists rolled in, they abolished the Hungarian House of Lords and all the nobility. And it was resuscitated in by another organization in honor of the old men, really. So what he's been given is a kind of resuscitation of an old chivalric order. This kind of detail doesn't bother Haaretz, which was the article I showed you from Israel, or any of the other people carrying it as a story. And it's become a hashtag, Gorka must go, because apparently he's a neo-Nazi in the White House. Again, the usual historical ignorance is at play. And what on earth else were men like Gorka's father supposed to do? Or in Gorka's grandparents' day, after the First World War, there was actually a Hungarian communist insurrection. And there was a year of chaos and as kind of cultural Marxist government teaching sex education to small children, which so disgusted the Hungarians that they threw this lot out. And that's cultural Marxism has come to the West now because the Hungarians threw it out and we received the guys instead. So really, Mr. Gorka's membership is of an organization which refused to let the Stalinists roll over Hungary as they did a number of other countries. And even that is enough to be a sin now in the eyes of the mainstream media. You have to be a completely compliant Marxist.
OK, well, let's end then with Russia. Well, this tweet here, you've asked me to highlight this, and you've suggested this is what the West is launching on Russia. Now, of course, yeah. Russia, with people on the streets over the weekend and lots of criticism from the British government about the arrests which followed. We'll be mentioning those in a second. What are your thoughts on this?
This is completely unknown in Russia, this kind of thing. And this chap who's, I think, wearing some kind of pretend transsexual wig. I know there's a small number of genuine transsexuals, and this chap is just playing a girl, basically. He's gone out on the streets with some kind of gold lame handbag out of which he has to whip his passport for the policeman, wearing ridiculous stack heels and just behaving like, I think the word he would want to use of it be used of himself is behaving like a slut. In a Russian march, which is quite ridiculous because you can see the policemen having to still wear their fur hats. So he's being mocked during that little clip by the bystanders. You know, are you not feeling the cold and so on? Are you not freezing your whatnots off? But this is the extent to which we are debasing Russia with cultural ideas, memes coming out of the West. You know, that this was all part of a wave of supposedly pro-opposition protests in Russia, which are really, they're just there to mock Putin.
Do we leave it at just mock, or do we actually say that this form of cultural Marxism is extremely dangerous? Because, of course, you're attacking the whole fabric of society. You're attacking morality, you're attacking social values, you're attacking children's minds in particular. This is an orchestrated program. This is an orchestrated program attacking the state rather than just Putin, isn't it?
It's very much towards the state rather than Putin, because in the same wave of so-called pro-opposition protests, well, you'll see what's happened in the same wave, but every level of society has become involved and they're being turned against the government and the police. And we can see more of the same. We've got in the latest wave of opposition protests in Russia, we've got people tweeting in Russia, compare the generations, you know, a boy who defended the fatherland in the Second World War versus, well, a man boy. Of the current generation, who's picked up from the idea from the West, the idea that you know, he needs to put on a childish smile and carry a picture of a rubber ducky as a way of bringing down the government. Apparently, we've got a boy of, I don't know, I would say about 8 there at most. And of course, what we know about Russia, anyone who knows, even if they've not been there, is the high standard in the schooling system. And so here he is in a sort of American or European style protest saying, we get too much homework. It's ridiculous. It's unacceptable. No homework. And he's turning that into an anti-government complaint, you see. So I think the Sorosites are obviously desperate for the Russians to become less well-educated and less eloquent and less world aware. And one way to do that, of course, is to get children to join these protests. And then when people get detained, yes, go on.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, we had an official statement from the Foreign Office complaining bitterly about the treatment of the protesters by the Russian government. And this tweet here seems to be contrasting on the left what happens if you're a Russian protester, and on the right, what happens if you're a protester in the United States.
That's absolutely right. This is a cynical tweeter called Golos Mordora, so the voice of Mordor, so a Tolkien pen name, as it were. And he's describing the первом фото кровавая диктатура. So on the left, in the first photograph, a bloody dictatorship, supposedly. На втором продвинутая демократия. So on the right is a leading democracy. This is all cynical, of course. A leading democracy with great respect for universal human rights. And look at the difference, he's saying. And of course, what the point is, if you're arrested in Russia, they don't frisk you for phones. You're able to take photos from the inside of the Black Mariah, wave at the camera, go off for questioning. On the right, some real children, and they look preteen to me, have been cable tied like turkeys. Yeah, absolutely. And there they are. These I'm not sure which city this was. I've got a vague feeling it may have been Seattle, judging from the uniforms and so on. But I might be wrong there. They're there with their great big truncheons. You know, trussing up these children. And so the Russians are just having a right old laugh at us here, that we continue to call Russia a bloody dictatorship when that's the discrepancy in how you get arrested for political protests.
Yes, and then we've got the people that are pushing out opposition, well, propaganda perhaps, and this tweet asking why Anna Veduta is tweeting stuff out in English.
Yes, Anna Veduta had got herself very popular on Twitter, saying, shock, horror, all these people, you know, 1,000 in Russia, nearly 800 just in Moscow being arrested. But strangely enough, she was tweeting in English. And so this tweeter, whom you can see replying to her, who calls himself Count Mingking of Haifa, that's obviously another joke, he's saying, excuse me, but why are you tweet or putting out messages in English? I don't think there was a response to that, but people have found out why. So you can see something about this this lady. First of all, we found out that she works for this website, which is called Medusa, as in the Gorgon Medusa, the hag of antiquity who deceived people. And if you look at the font at the top left there, you can see it's a German Fraktur font, which is a reference to Western Ukraine support for neo-Nazism. So that's what she writes for, this so-called independent site. Then it was discovered that she lives in Washington, D.C., and really that explains it all. And you can even see in the people she's followed, she is following US State Department account, and she's following the account on Twitter of the head of the New York Bureau, of the Moscow Bureau of the New York Times. So we've got State Department assets, again, just like in the other former Soviet countries, pretending to be on the ground in the protests. But I think that the hopeful thing is that judging by the Russian Twitter sphere, there is a great deal of uproarious humor being had by the Russians here because they've seen it all before. The Sorosites have been too slow off the mark. They started practicing this stuff in Georgia and Ukraine well over a decade ago, more like 20 years now. And the Russians have had plenty of time at government and popular level to see, oh, I see, that's where this stuff is coming from. So when they see half-naked protesters and children not wanting to go to school, or men dressed as women on the streets, people being thrown into police vans and saying, help, help, I'm being repressed, you know, like in Life of Brian for out of fashion, this is all well known to the Russians now. So they know every trick in the playbook. So I have some confidence that they'll be able to resist this.